Turning today to Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 10 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians, chapter 10, verse 13. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will, with the temptation, also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. The subject is the control of temptation and of trial. And in our studies in 1 Corinthians, we've come to this chapter and to this particular great verse. It seems at first sight to be a verse out of context. There's been a tremendous exhortation by the apostle to avoid sin. There has been the apostle pointing to the journeys of the children of Israel in olden times as examples to us and warning how they fell in certain respects into certain sins. And yet this verse seems to be not so much about temptation to sin, but about trial. The word temptation can be seen either as a temptation to sin or as a trial that comes upon us. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. And then the words seem to imply that this is all about God's relief in trial. And so it's always been debated, is the apostle here speaking in context? Is it, after all, something to do with sin? Or has he changed the subject for this single verse to trials before he goes back to the subject of sin? Well, the answer is, it is both. The verse is about temptation to sin and bearing up under trial. And indeed, the context requires that. And just by way of introduction, I point you back to verse 5 of the chapter. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Clearly, that's about sin. And verse 6, now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted, without reminding you what these verses directly refer to. That's sin. Verse 7, neither be ye idolaters. Clearly it's sin. Committing fornication, verse 8. But then verse 9, neither let us tempt Christ. Well, that's sin, but it is because of the trial they had to endure that caused them to fall into discontent and murmuring and complaining. So trial is inherent here as well as sin. And verse 10, neither murmur ye, same problem. They reacted very unreasonably to their trials and became disenchanted and complained. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured. Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples or patterns. So is a promise in verse 13 about God's help in trial and God's help in temptation also. So we'll look at the verse in that way. There hath no temptation or trial taken you, but such as is common to man. Taken you. What an interesting term. Taken you. Some of the modern translations go for overtaken you. And in this instance, that's not a bad idea, because the Greek translated taken you does actually imply that. You being taken by surprise, temptations or trials that you didn't expect, that come upon you rather suddenly, unexpectedly. This verse is not for sin that you plan to commit, anything of that kind, something which is premeditated, some sin which you think about and walk into knowingly, you choose to indulge in. We'll come to that in a moment. This is particularly a promise for trials that are not of your making, and they're not your fault, and they come upon you, or temptation to sin, which just overtakes you and seizes hold of you. Now, there's a special promise for such things, and we read about it in this verse. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. What about these trials? What trials does the apostle have in mind? Well, we may think of hardship and loss. It may be that people fall into hardship and poverty and very great need, or lose things, suffer great loss, as in sudden unemployment, reduction, serious reduction in income and so on, loss by theft or anything of something precious to you, or you may suffer defamation and insult and slander, which hurts you greatly and disadvantages you. You may be rejected by people who were for you or even friends of yours. You may suffer persecution for the faith. Any of these trials, there are special promises attached to them. You may suffer bereavement, which is very hard for you to bear, or you may suffer an illness, a very debilitating or difficult or painful illness. You may know disappointments, serious disappointments, or you may suffer from deeply felt failure on your own part. You couldn't cope with something. You couldn't do something. You made a great mistake, and it was very injurious to you and hurtful, and you were ashamed of yourself. So this pain and trial, it can arise from any of these sources. And then there are sins which arise from trials. Self-pity is obvious. A trial knocks us aside, and we respond very badly, and we go around, not audibly, but in our minds, muttering to ourselves, nursing ourselves, feeling sorry for ourselves, perhaps harbouring anger or resentment to others, or jealousy of others because they haven't had such trials and difficulties, or our pride may be very wounded and hurt, so we react with temper and anger, or we doubt God, or we fail to praise him and to keep up our love for him and our adoration and put our heart into it and thank him because we enter into a contention with him, though we wouldn't dare put it like that or articulate it, and we feel this is all very unreasonable and God hasn't protected us as he ought. So there is trial and there is a sinful reaction to trial. And then there are sins quite outside this scheme of things. At any time, you may fall to ambition or to temper or to pride or to greed. Or you may, well, think of the sins that are named in the scripture. The breaking of the Sabbath, of the Lord's day, unnecessarily, unreasonably. And you sweep it aside. Or deceit, dishonesty, the sudden lie, the dishonest excuse. So sin can rush up temptation, and if we're too relaxed and we're not alert and we're not watching, down we go. But here is a special promise for help for trial and for sudden temptation and sin, and it's the promise of a way of escape. There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. Well, let's look at that little phrase. Such as is common to men. I ought to say that this promise, I mentioned this earlier, but I'll amplify this, does not apply to premeditated sin. This is something that has taken you. It just comes, temptation to sin or trial. But if you plan to do it, and if you will to do it, well, God may deliver you over to the sin, so that you suffer the consequences and you get worse and worse, and that sin gets its tentacles round you and you plunge down into misery and loss of spiritual blessing, and it's the discipline of the Lord who will use a punishment perhaps to bring you back. So willful, voluntary sin is very serious. You think of some extreme sins like pornography. Why, there's no, the promise of verse 13 doesn't apply to this. It's willful, it's planned, it's not resisted, and it'll get a grip on your mind, and it'll pollute your imagination, and it'll get to destroying you, and it'll require a great determination and act of God's help to deliver you. But you see, this isn't something sudden that's overcome you. It's something that has been allowed, and that's terrible. Or imagine substance abuse, or the modern form of substance abuse, dependence upon rhythm. Yes, it's a kind of drug. I must have it. I must have pulsating, thumping rhythm coming through my headphones constantly, most of my time, to lift me up. I can't live without it. I get to this stage. Well, that's willful. I plan to subject myself to this. Gets a grip of you. Can't live without it. Takes you into compromise. You have to listen to all sorts of sinful things, and it dominates you. Well, all these things, this promise doesn't apply to that. When it comes to idolatry, the Apostle Paul has something else to say. Verse 14, "Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. Shun it with all your might. Don't walk into that idol temple. Don't do those things. Don't plan to sin. It's not about willful sin." Verse 12, "Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall." We have to be on the watch all the time. But verse 13, I must go through the verse, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man." The only trials that we suffer, and the only temptations that rush upon us to sin, are distinctively human. They are common to all human beings, to all Christians, in the case of Christians. Our trial will never be any worse than countless others' experience. That's a very controlling thought. It's mildly reproving. I was getting to think nobody in the world has ever suffered like me. This is utterly unreasonable. No, says the Apostle. It is a typically, distinctively human trial or suffering. Don't run away with the idea that you're entitled to collapse into self-pity or anger or frustration. No, it's distinctively human. It's the temptation or the trial is no different from those that have been experienced by human beings since the beginning of time. Now, the application is this. First of all, temptation will come. It is human. I don't mean it is human so as to give an excuse. Oh, it's human to be tempted. It's human to fall into sin. It's human to bear up badly under trials. No, no, no. But it's human to get temptations. It's human to suffer trials. So it will happen. Be ready for it. The sun comes out tomorrow morning and it's a nice day. You don't go forth into your daily work thinking, oh, everything is happy and nice and pleasant. I can go into a relaxing day. Do my job with my mind at peace, always on guard, always ready for temptation or for trial, to handle it well. That's essential because it's inevitable with human beings. That's the first application. The second is, I mentioned, you can never suffer anything worse than other people. So there's no excuse for us to respond badly. There is actually no reason for us to fall. God's provisions are all sufficient, whether it's trials, hardship, loss, defamation, persecution, all these things, bereavement, illness. Billions of people, Christian and non-Christian, have suffered these problems for generations. It is typical suffering and trial in a fallen world, and ours is no worse. And we are Christians. The devil cannot possess us. Demons cannot enter into us. Something beyond human experience can never overtake us. Don't imagine it can. And by the way, when I mention persecution, and this is just a minor digression, you know, even persecution, this word applies. Such as is common to man. Do you know that persecution against Christians would be taking place all over the world in every century, in every age, were it not for the restraining hand of God, because it is typically human. Fallen human beings who are outside the kingdom of God will persecute the people of God. If God took off his restraining hand, there would be persecution instantly in every land all the time, just as there would be war all the time. Human nature is so fallen and war is so common to him. If God did not restrain human nature, there would be war everywhere and there would be persecution of believers everywhere. The world hates you, Christ taught. Well, in this country, if you find people at work, people in the family circle and so on, people at college are indifferent to your faith and quite happy to relate to you and quite calm about your being a Christian, that isn't human nature. That's because there is the restraining hand of God upon people, making them like that, so that the gospel can prosper, the word of God can go forth. We should be so thankful to God that, you know, there are parts of the world, as you know, that are chosen for that hand of God to come off and the people of God are persecuted. Why is that? Why does God allow the persecution in some places and not in others? Most of the world, on balance, just at the moment, is free from persecution of Christians. But many places are still suffering it. Why does God choose some of his people to have to endure persecution and relieve others? And we are blessed by being relieved from these things. Well, it is because it has to be demonstrated that that is the normal condition of man, to persecute believers, to be constantly, aggressively against the faith, in a physical as well as in an intellectual and legal way. In this country, we are suffering now legal persecution. We are certainly suffering intellectual persecution. And the forces of unbelief are trying to press us completely out of the world of education, out of everything, if they can, out of participation in society. But we don't suffer physical persecution. But for God's restraining hand, we would. And the words of the apostle are actually true in every respect. Such as is common to man, it is distinctively fallen humanity, typical of man's heart, to persecute believers. So if you should be disadvantaged in your place of employment, this will help you not to feel sorry for yourself. Is this all I have to experience? Some delay of promotion? Some disadvantage when in other parts of the world those who love my Lord are subjected to bitter and terrible physical persecution? And there are women in Pakistan, as you know, who have been accused of blasphemy against their Islamic faith, who are violently beaten and cast into prison and tried and the death sentence pronounced upon them and things of that kind. Well, we must pray for them when we feel some self-pity on our own account, and thank God that we are not called to stand for him in those circumstances. But that is by way of digression, friends. This is all typical of human nature. There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man, but God is faithful. That's the second time the apostle has used that expression in this first letter to the Corinthians. I could turn you back for a moment to chapter 1 and verse 9. God is faithful, by whom ye were called unto the fellowship of his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. And all through those verses in chapter 1 up to verse 9, there has been expressed the security of our salvation and enrichment, culminating in the words, God is faithful, the perseverance of the saints, the goodness of God towards his people. And it amounts to this, that when you're tempted, and you're strongly tempted to some sin, remember that Christ is pledged to help you by his Spirit, that his eye is upon you, that he's near to you. He never loses sight of you. And he is available and will respond to your call instantly. God is faithful. He will help you in the temptation if you call upon him. In the time of trial, whatever the kind of trial, God will help you. There is never any reason for us to give up or for us to despair. His sympathy is unbounded. Look again at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. There are some wonderful statements here. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you, that means allow you or let you, will not let you to be tempted above that ye are able. He will not allow a trial or a temptation of Satan to come to you, which is above your capacity to resist and to cope with, and by his help to bear up under. He prevents excess, temptation, and trial. Did you not know that? That God knows and understands your limit, or what is reasonable for you, what he will require from you. Oh, we would set our limit quite low. Lord, I would like the limit of the height or the depth of my trial to be quite a low limit. Well, God would probably put the limit higher than we would desire, but he's got a limit for us. And the limit probably varies. If you're sick, if you're poorly, if you're discouraged already by something, God will probably bring that limit down. I don't know, but I'm sure he would. And if you're strong, and if you're in a capable frame or phase of your life, he may put that limit up. But there is a limit, and he will not let you be either tempted or tried above that you are able to bear by his help. And that's a very special thought, and that's a revelation through the Apostle Paul to us to comfort us. God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able. All is under his limit. We will certainly never be tempted or tried as Christ was. And we think of that. We think of his temptation when the devil came to him, particularly as it is recorded. We will never suffer temptation as Christ suffered it. What he suffered in his humiliation, as people disbelieved him and rejected him and leered at him, some of the scribes and the Pharisees persecuted him, tracked him down. We will never suffer the burdens of Christ, even before he went to Calvary. And on Calvary, and even in the run-up to Calvary, the three times scourging, and then Calvary's cross, and the weight of the guilt and the punishment of our sin, and the devils of darkness hemming him round. Why, his hardships and his temptations and his trials were infinitely beyond anything he will call upon us to bear. He will limit our sufferings and decrease our exposure to them. So never think your trial is unreasonable. God has everything in hand, however hard. Never think that you have an excuse to succumb to a temptation. Oh, this was too powerful for me. No, it's not so. God would not allow the devil to hurl at you something that it was beyond your capacity to bear with. Now, of course, you may be in dire trouble if you willfully and planningly go in for various sins. God may deliver you over to them. But no, if you look to him and you do not plan to sin, God will help you and limit what comes to you. Sometimes people ask about violence. Does this apply to violence? What should we do in circumstances of violence? Well, this is an oversimplification in this answer, but let's think of two kinds of violence. Let's think of violence suffered for Christ. in persecution, people who suffer physical attack and abuse. Well, that we endure, and we endure it for Christ's sake, and he will enable us, and he will grant special grace, as we saw even in the history of our land, in times of severe persecution, the time of the Reformation, those who were burned at the stake. God grants amazing grace that comes with those moments. But this doesn't apply to all violence. If you suffer criminal violence, or God forbid, if you should suffer violence in the home, you do not have to endure that. That is not violence for Christ's sake. God has declared on that otherwise, that that is criminal, and that should be punished, and that is wrong. And so, if you suffer unreasonably violence in the world, which isn't part of Christian persecution, you take what redress you can, and you must, and the person should be punished. The old writers used to put it like this, that the first kind of violence is covered by God's promise of grace. The second kind of violence is covered by God's pronouncement of punishment upon the sinner and redress. So there's a distinction. Anyway, that was a digression. Let's look back at verse 13. God will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will, with the temptation, also make a way to escape, an exit. Now, it's been pointed out for generations that the way this word is used in classical Greek literature, it can suggest a mountain defile, a pass, or some great fissure in the mountain which would lead you to escape. There are troops trapped on a mountainside or in a mountain valley. They're ambushed and trapped and they can't get out. But then it's understood or realized there is a pass, there is a fissure in the rocks, there's some cleft through which they can make their escape. So the language, you see, ties in with overtaken by temptation. Something suddenly comes. There is a way out. Does that mean I get completely away from the trial? There is a way out. If I look to God, my illness will disappear. My trial will disappear. The hostility, whatever it is I'm bearing, will be cured. No. It means there is a way out of sin. There's a way out of reacting badly. There's a way out of being crushed by the trial. There's a way out of committing the sin, which needs to be taken quickly as an emergency. This is not a verse about total deliverance, though God in his mercy sometimes may give us total deliverance. Look, we know it's not about total deliverance because of how it goes on. But will, with the temptation, also make a way to escape, and then that ye may be able to bear it. So, what is not meant is a clean escape, a clean freedom from the trial, but a way to escape being unable to bear it. Now, what's that? What way of escape will God provide? And as we move to conclusion, I need to deal with some of those things, the way of escape. Well, there is a doctrinal way of escape. When Thomas Watson wrote his beautiful little book, it's a small book with a strange title, The Crook in the Lot. It's out these days. The book is still available. It's got a better title, much more understandable nowadays. It began saying he was going to address typical Puritan work, trials and tribulation, and give comfort. That's the introduction. As soon as you get to the first page of the book proper, what is he doing? He's talking about doctrines. And that's exactly the Puritan way. And this is what part of the Apostles' remedy. What is the way to escape a trial? First of all, to think of the truths of God. Comfort your heart with those. These are the greatest comforts if you're a Christian. If you say to yourself, oh, I don't want doctrines, I want somebody to speak very soothingly to me. I want some sort of a Christian psychologist to come and somehow manipulate my mind and give me relief and comfort and friendship and help. I want somebody to sit with me and to, or I want to turn on the television and watch some comedy or something like that. Doctrine? Is that going to help me and give me comfort? Oh yes, the Puritans would say. That's the very best comfort. Think of the wonderful doctrines. Think of Christ, how he came to deliver you from sin. Think of his love. Think of the price he paid. Think of the nature of conversion. Think of the scale of conversion. Turned from hell to heaven. Turned from a person fixed in sin under the control of appetites and the devil to a person with spiritual life and tastes and happiness and an eternal future. Doctrinally, think of your blessings and the cost of them to Christ and what he has done and the future that lies before you. That's the way for comfort. For Christians, that's the uplifting way. But then, there's not only a doctrinal mountain pass to help us in trial and in sudden temptation. There's a devotional pass too. I give thanks. That's what we must do. Praise and thank God. Thank him for who he is. Thank him for his mighty power, that he superintends all affairs to the good of his people. All things work together for good, to the spiritual and eternal good of the people of God, to them that love God. Think of these things. Think of redemption. Same as the doctrinal approach. Think of what has been provided in redemption and how God has gone about it. By paying the price for sin himself, by Christ being our representative, earning heaven for us, taking the punishment for our sin, and then thank him for personal salvation. And I have experienced this. I, who deserved nothing at all, who had done nothing for God, who had gone away from him all through my years, I received this grace. I was pardoned and forgiven. I was granted new life. And all the things he's done for me ever since I've found him, every great prayer that has been answered, all the amazing things, and even my ministry of intercession for others has been blessed and heard on high. Devotionally, I will remind myself of these things and his great goodness and faithfulness and all the light and understanding that he gives to his children and that he's given to me and all the blessings and favors and patience shown to us. And then heaven, what is in store for us? What is the future? Great things, amazing things, the greatest adventures any human being could possibly have. For the soul to be transported one day from time into eternity, to see Christ, to know all things. Devotionally, this is a mountain pass. We think of these great and amazing things, and our hearts are warmed, and we're lifted up to heaven. And like Paul and Silas in a Philippian dungeon, we find ourselves singing praise to God. These are the mountain passes, the way out of being crushed by the burden of any trial or being overtaken and brought down by sudden temptations to sin. This is the way, and the apostle tells us so, that ye may be able to bear it, to bear the trial, to endure it, to bear it up, to withstand the temptation. Here are other mountain passes. Are you tempted to some ambition that won't leave you? The temptation comes and overwhelms you to give way to this. Are you tempted to respond in an angry, uncalled for way, in an unkind, uncharitable way, in a testy way, a proud way, to some word that you've heard, or some deed that has been done you in the home or in your place of business? Hate the sin. Remember Christ's eyes upon you. Remember you're here to please him and to live for him. These are mountain passes away from the trap just to reflect and to offer an emergency prayer. Pray for help. Resist, discard the sin, the temptation. God will give you power. What's the biblical word for it? Mortify it. Put it to death and he will enable you. Why some people, they don't understand how God gives his strength and his power. They think if they pray and they say, deliver me from this temptation, God will just do it. But that's not how it works. You pray and then you resist it. And as you resist it, God strengthens your resistance and enables you. That's always the way. Remember that illustration I gave you some time ago? It's such a simple one, I'm almost ashamed to tell you. I told you about the lady who parks her car and her bicycle not very far from mine in the car park where we live. And this bicycle, I've explained it before, it's an amazing contraption. And it has no throttle. It's motorized. It's got a little motor in the back wheel and so on. And it's very posh, very slick. And I asked her once, well, how does it work if there's no throttle? And she said, well, it just helps as you need it. If you don't pedal, it does nothing. But as soon as you pedal, especially when you're going uphill, the power comes on and you're assisted. And that's exactly how God helps us. In resisting temptation, we must mortify, we must resist it, we must put it out of our mind. But if we're depending upon him, he will magnify our resistance and help us. That's where his help comes. No prayer, no dependence upon God, you're on your own. But you pray to him in times of special temptation and need, and then resist that temptation. However attractive, however powerful, God will strengthen you as you mortify, as you reject, as you resist that temptation, and you will be given a way of escape. And the text applies in that way. Will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. Friends, verse 14, wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. Flee those sins, compromises, premeditated sin, planned sin, allowed sin, things that will get hold of you, things that will bring you down. If anybody's looking at things they shouldn't be looking at, oh, go on your knees and pray for special help. The tentacles are coming round you. Break that entirely. Shun it. Flee from it. Don't put yourselves in situations where you may succumb or be exposed to any such temptation. And for all sudden temptation and for every trial in life, God has a protective limit for you. Whether it's grief, bereavement, anything, don't say, I cannot but be utterly overwhelmed. Oh no, says the apostle. I read the verse in conclusion. There hath no temptation or trial taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will, with the temptation, also make a way, doctrinally, devotionally, by mortifying the sin, to escape, that ye may be able to bear it for his name's sake. Let's close our thinking, singing the hymn 445.